This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey, everybody. The Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes of this program are available for free, more than 570 episodes and counting. It's all free. Your support makes a difference. If you would like to support this show, you can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. That's patreon.com/otherpplpod. Thanks.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
My sunglasses.
What a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listing.
Just one person at
hey,
just one time.
How's it going? Right. Hello. Right. How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listy, and I'm here in Los Angeles. It's good to be with you. Thank you for tuning in. I have Richard Chim on the program today. He has a new novel out on Soft Skull Press. It is called King of Joy. And I had a great time meeting Richard in person for the first time. This is his second appearance on the podcast. We spoke over the transom a few years ago. But this time around, he was in town on tour. He came over and sat down with me, and it was just delightful. So you're going to hear that in just a moment. I do have some mail that I want to get through. The first letter comes from a listener named Thomas who says, "Dear Brad, I work with a couple of guys who have face tattoos. They're good dudes. I think it's the really clean-cut, shirt-tucked, buttoned-up guys you got to look out for." Signed, Thomas. I mean, I can't argue with that. I think there's some truth to it. And I'm also racking my brain. Did I make a joke at the expense of people with face tattoos? I'm sorry if I did that. If you have a face tattoo, I don't mean to pigeonhole you. It's like, you know, it's kind of like an easy, like low-hanging fruit kind of joke. Like if you have a face tattoo, it's one of those life decisions that's hard to live down. You know what I'm talking about. But I have nothing against people with face tattoos. If you have a face tattoo and you're a good person, great. And I think what Thomas is saying about the buttoned up guys being the ones you really got to look out for, there can be some truth to that. Or not. I'm always, I have like this discomfort around people who are super competitive. Like those guys, you know, if we're going to be working in this particular vein, if we're thinking in these terms, like some, you know, these guys who are super buttoned up, every I is dotted, every T is crossed, they're biohacking themselves, they're super fit. You know, it's just like, holy cow. I find myself like preemptively exhausted. That's what it does to me. Like I think that the more natural Darwinian response, or like maybe the more user-friendly Darwinian response would be to react or respond to that kind of behavior by competing with it, right? But for me, it's like it's like the air has been let out of my heart. I'm just like, oh God. I just need to go lie down for a moment. I'm tired. These people exhaust me. And I got to say, I often have that feeling when I'm moving through life, like just walking around, watching everybody going places in their cars, talking on their phones. Not that I don't do these things too, but when I'm observing it, I'm just like, where's everybody going? Like, don't you realize you're going to die? Like, what are we doing? So thank you, Thomas, for writing to me. I appreciate it. A listener named Franco writes to me. He says, "Hi, Brad. I've been going through the archives of the show for a couple of months now, and I just wanted to reach out and say how much I appreciate your efforts with the Other People podcast. To be honest, the end of 2018 was really rough for me. I decided to follow some advice I heard from a lot of other people guests and stop trying to use my writing as a source of income, to let it instead be something that I do for the love of it. While I ended up writing more this year and last year than I ever have in my life, I've also gone through incredible periods of doubt. I see friends from my undergrad program going off to get their MFAs while I work on learning a whole new set of skills in the form of a job and a degree in the helping services. It's been really hard not to feel like an imposter, like I'm not doing the writing thing all the way, and to have the motivation to keep going with much of anything. Your podcast has helped me break out of that mindset. I've realized through listening to you and your guests that there really is no quote-unquote correct way to be a writer. You just have to write and have discipline with your writing." Signed, Franco. The only thing I would add, Franco, is that you have to read too. What do I always go back to? It's like when people ask me what I've learned from this show, talking to all these writers, I boil it down to three things. One, don't do it for the money. Two, read a lot. Three, write every day or close to it. That's really it. I think as writers, we credential ourselves, and you can't really fake it. You've either done the work or you haven't. You've either done the work as a reader and it shows up on the page, or you haven't and it shows up on the page. You've either done the work in front of the keyboard or in front of the blank page, or you haven't. Either way, it shows up. But nobody blesses you and makes you a writer. You make yourself a writer. And if you do that through an MFA program, fine. If you don't, fine. And frankly, you know, taking the road less traveled and doing something different than getting your MFA in creative writing might lead you into a more interesting set of possibilities. I mean, I can tell you that here I am in my 40s, and recently, I'm still trying to figure my shit out. And recently I was thinking, like, maybe I should go back and get a degree and become like a counselor. You know, just because the only thing that I'm really naturally any good at is just talking to people. So I hear you. I'm assuming too, that when you talk about getting a degree and getting a job in the helping services, that it has some therapeutic connotation. But I'm right there with you. And I have a friend who became a therapist, and it wound up helping her writing. It certainly didn't hurt it. And really, whatever it is that you do. I mean, look at Bud Smith. But, you know, Bud is out there. He's got a union job. He's working, a nuclear power plant or something? People do all sorts of things to make ends meet while they write their books. And if you really are a writer and you really can't not do it, then you'll do it. And as far as, you know, the whole money thing goes, I just think from an enjoyment standpoint, especially if you're working in a literary vein or if you're a poet or something, to go into it with all of this pressure around breadwinning just poisons the process. It's too much. It's far too statistically unlikely that you're ever going to make more than a few bucks on your writing. Not that it can't happen. Of course it can. There's plenty of examples of people who have sold millions of copies of their literary fiction or their literary nonfiction. And that's great. But I feel like when that happens, there's something cosmic at work and there's a strong element of chance involved. And if you want to drive yourself crazy, you try to thread that needle and be that one and put all that weight on yourself while you're composing. I think the happier warriors that I've met through, this podcast have been the ones who just did it because they had something to say. And if the book wound up finding a big readership, it was kind of it was kind of magic. Not that you don't try to advocate for your book, not that you don't go out and talk to people like me or, write guest blogs or what, try to build a platform, whatever it is you're supposed to do to advocate for your book. Like doing all those things is fine and appropriate. I think that's what I would do. I mean, you spend all that time working on a book, you want it to find a readership. So it's good to do everything you possibly can to help it. But at some point you've got to let it go. And really the truth of the matter is that it comes down to like word of mouth, one reader passing on the book or word about the book to another reader. And on a deeper level, there's an element of magic involved. It's timing. It's cosmic. I don't think in nearly 600 interviews that I've done that I've gotten much closer to the truth than with that. So I appreciate the kind words, Franco. Good luck to you. And just keep doing your work. Let the cards fall.
This episode is brought to you by Buffalo Trace Distillery. Powerful yet smooth. Contained but never tame. Proudly going their own way, but never going alone. This is the spirit inside Buffalo Trace Bourbon. Made at Buffalo Trace Distillery, the world's most award-winning distillery. Buffalo Trace is always perfectly untamed. Distilled, aged, and bottled by Buffalo Trace Distillery, Franklin County, Kentucky. 90 proof, 45% alcohol by volume. Learn more at buffalotracedistillery.com. Please drink responsibly.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
My guest today is Richard Chim. His new novel, King of Joy, is available now from Soft Skull Press. It was such a good time getting to see Richard and talk to him. And I hope you enjoy this conversation. Here he is, folks. This is Richard Chim, and his novel, one more time, is called King of Joy.
You know, I first started writing the book, actually. I'm going to sound like a major stoner, but I got really high and watched Carney Corinne's Spring Breakers. And was so stimulated by the film. I wrote, like, the first scene, which is like just the main character Corvus watching another character, Amber, burn down a tree. And once I had the character Corvus, I kind of proceeded to do a novel.
What was it about the character Corvus that opened it up for you?
I heavily related to her. She's a very sad person. It's actually an homage to, there's a book I really love called The Quick and the Dead by Joey Williams. There's a character in there that's also Corvus. And when I read it for the first time, I thought she was one of the saddest characters I ever read. And I wanted my Corvus to give kind of homage to that Corvus. So that's where the name comes from. But yeah, I kind of had this general idea of a woman that was going through a great loss and how she kind of gets through that is exactly what the novel is. Yeah, it was fun to write, too. It took a while.
But I mean, like, had you experienced any, like, great loss that you were relating to?
Not similar to what she went through, but I'm definitely a sad, depressed person. So it was kind of easy for me to kind of work through my own periods of grief, actually, through that novel.
Yeah. Have you been through a lot of loss?
Here and there, yes.
Okay. I mean, we all are. Like, this is, I mean, I say this sort of selfishly, and, like, I think we're going to have a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
Just because I'm writing a griefy book. Isn't everyone?
No, I know you are.
I'm like, I need to stop talking about it. But I guess like the fact that you made it to the finish line and you found a way to do it that didn't feel suffocating. I mean, did you experience any of that? Like, I feel like it's such a tonal struggle. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like trying to come up with a way to write it so that the reader isn't like, doesn't feel like battered at the end of it or something.
Totally. And I think that's a really good consideration. I don't know. It goes back to, an editor I really like. Her name's Kristen Iverson. She's the editor for Nylon.
Yeah. I know Kristen.
Yeah. She's really wonderful. She articulated really well that she like reads, essentially she reads novels about grief, not because she wants to feel more sadness, but there's something about watching like or witnessing like a strange narrative of someone surviving something incredibly weird and sad, just to know someone else can survive it. So for me, I think it was just providing another example into that weirdness in a way.
But I mean, like, but specifically,
yeah,
like including weirdness or magical realism or elements of surreality,
right?
You know, that is an important element to like. It's like the spoonful of sugar or something that makes the medicine go down. Like, was that kind of like what helped you crack it?
The surreal aspect definitely helped me kind of because I didn't want to beat the reader up. There's almost so much suffering you could put the reader through. I didn't necessarily want to make the book entertaining, but you wanted to make the book accessible in a way for the kind of the jumping off point to be, it is a novel about grief, but it's also a novel about, like, there's a hippo attack at the end of it. And I like that.
A hippopotamus attack.
Exactly right, sir.
And when did that occur to you? How much pot are you smoking, Richard?
Maybe a little too much. I actually read this Washington Post or article like years ago about a man surviving a hippo attack, and the article was so visceral I like couldn't stop thinking about it. And I also knew once I kind of had those surreal elements in my head I could make this novel work, because I think you do need to have a balance. Well, in my particular view, when I did this particular grief novel, I needed like a balance of like the surreal, not like a red herring to distract the reader, but just to have, because I think when we are in moments of grief, the details that are known to us in those moments are strangely vibrant and are kind of weird. It's that like truth is stranger than fiction kind of thing, which kind of gave me more privilege to kind of go a little more adventurous in like where this novel went. I didn't feel like embarrassed to kind of go there, because there were sad elements too. But I think you can ground those in very strange, shiny objects.
Yeah, it's like, it's weird terrain, grief.
Yeah, unfortunately so.
But also...
heavily relatable.
Heavily relatable, but I think maybe that element of the grieving process is underplayed. Just how weird it is. Maybe it's because you're paying more attention, or, you know, it sort of opens you up.
And I think so.
You're noticing more.
Yeah, you have to be more honest.
Why, though? Like, I guess you're confronted with, like, the ultimate reality, so...
Well, if you're faking on the page, I think the reader can tell, too. So it's like, to me, I always tell my students, it's about getting to the truth of whatever your character is without being cliche. So you have to ask yourself really good questions, really strange questions, as you kind of work scene by scene.
Well, like, what kinds of questions?
Like, when we think what grief looks like, and you build out a scene, I think you have to always ground or anchor that to, scenes of, like, identity. Like, for one, my main character is not, she is me, but she's also not me. I'm a cis male, she's not a cis male. I think she has a greater capacity for emotion than I do, which made her a great hero for the book. But because she is not me, I had to ask myself questions that would have to answer the truth of what her suffering might look like and how she would need to survive it, or the methods she would need to take upon herself to survive it, because she is who she is. It gets really complicated, but I did ask many questions while writing it, just to make sure it stayed authentic to whatever I thought she was going through.
And before we get any further, I do want to ask you about this hippo attack that you read about.
Yeah.
Because hippos kill more people every year than sharks.
Totally. They're like the third most dangerous animal in Africa.
Yeah.
After like people and mosquitoes.
Like incredibly powerful jaws.
Yeah. Really grumpy. Like incredibly grumpy.
Fast?
Yeah. 35 miles an hour on land, I think.
Oh, fuck.
I know.
They don't look like they could run that fast.
I know, they're so cute too, but they're also very territorial and dangerous.
And they can basically like bite you in half.
Yeah.
So what happened in this attack that you read about?
Well, one, I had no idea hippos could even do that. I was on the other, I think the reasons why the death rate is so high with hippos or killing people is people heavily underestimate them. So I always think of them as like really cute creatures, which they are. But, like, they're, like, folks out on safari that think the same thing. and they get too close, so then they get rampaged by hippos that are incredibly territorial.
Is it usually like land-based attacks, or people like swimming and
in the water? Usually, like their boat gets capsized. That's what the Washington Post article referred to. This man that used to take folks on like safari trips, and they went on the water, and their boat capsized, and then the next thing he knew, he was like essentially inside the mouth of a hippo, and that was it was one of the it was so visceral, but I also thought it was something out of Jaws or something. I just never knew that they had that capacity.
And did he survive?
He survived it, yeah.
With what injuries?
I think he had an amputated limb. At one point, he saw his own lung like floating out of his body.
Oh my god!
I'm sorry, Brett.
No, like I always say, like you know, the end of a life is going to be difficult, probably no matter what, on some level.
Right.
Like, please God, don't let me be a meal.
Exactly.
You know, just to get eaten alive. Holy shit!
He survived though.
I know, but still.
Yeah.
I guess, like, I mean, what was his attitude like afterwards? Did you get a sense?
He had mad respect for the hippo after that. Which then, yeah, I did too after that.
Well, yeah. I mean, and you owe that hippo the, part of your book.
I do, yeah. All my friends always gift me, like, hippo things now, too. It's really quite lovely. Like, my room's filled with, like, hippo memorabilia.
It's like your luck. It's like a totem or like a talisman.
Kind of. I'm, like, tied to it. I feel quite lovely about it.
You think there are going to be more hippos in your work as like a recurring motif?
I actually was joking about it with a couple of friends a couple of days ago, but I think I'm working on a novella in the perspective of the hippo in the book. But like maybe before all this happened, just like, not like a joke, but like a fun novella to work on.
Sometimes when I hear about these, like this woman who just got mauled by a jaguar. Mm. Do you read about this?
No, but that's horrible.
Well, no, it's kind of... It's one of these stories where, like, the woman's at the zoo.
Oh, I did hear about
that. She climbs over the barrier.
For, like, a photo or something?
To take a selfie. And I think the jaguar reached through the bars and, like, swiped her with its claw. I'm not 100% sure. I want to say it was through bars. But still, like, sometimes when I hear about animal attacks in nature, and then I'm also, like, reading about, like, climate change and just, like, human foolishness.
Tons of that, yeah.
There's a part of me that's like... Nature's pissed.
Right. I think the dude said something about, we're not going to kill the jaguar, which I think was really cool. I think I saw something like that.
Yeah. No, the zoo said no. The woman jumped the barrier. It's not the jaguar's fault. The jaguar is a wild animal.
Exactly.
But like, what is it with people?
I don't know, man.
Like, you gotta be a complete moron.
They want the photo. They want the likes.
Yeah. Well, so do I. But like, I don't want to get, it's a fucking jaguar, you know? Like, I go hiking in the morning. And it's dark when I go. And there's a mountain lion that lives in Griffith Park.
Yeah.
I think about it every morning.
Mountain lions are scary. They're probably the creatures I'm most afraid of in the wild. Because they will hunt you.
They will hunt you and you won't know until it's like on top of you.
Right.
And I'm always like, I don't want to jinx myself, but it's just like, how can this, it's not that big of a park.
Right.
How can this thing be living up there? There's people everywhere.
Right.
How can there not be any problems? Why are they letting it stay? I don't want it to get hurt, but it's like, why can't we move this thing to a better habitat?
I don't know, man. Is it like just one?
It's just one. Because I think what happened is it crossed the Highway 101.
Oh, wow.
Just to get into the park. Like, it's very unlikely. And it's also because of human encroachment on natural habitat. The mountain lion population has been dramatically reduced. So there's all this inbreeding.
Sure.
So it's like this... like lone bachelor mountain lion or bachelorette. I can't remember if it's male or female, but it's inbred. It's the, you know, I want to say genetically, it's like, you know, generationally inbred from this very small batch of lions that lives in the mountains around here. And this one happens to be essentially trapped by freeways.
Oh, wow.
Inside of Griffith Park, which is like a city park.
And people like run in that park and everything?
Yeah.
It's like totally accessible?
Yeah.
That is wild stuff.
I know. So, I don't know. It's weird to have, like, this lion living in this park that I go to.
That's awesome, though.
It is.
But that would affect my morning run.
Because like, they especially track runners.
Right.
Or people on mountain bikes and stuff like
that. Yeah, just do it.
So, okay. So, depression, you mentioned.
Yep.
Like, you've struggled with this your whole life? Is this something you have to medicate? I mean, obviously with the pot, maybe, like, you're medicating, but...
Yeah, I would say I've been, like, a sad, depressed person, but it's been better and better each year, I would say. Like, I'm definitely better than I was, like, 10 years ago. And finding, like, better coping mechanisms. Like I mentioned earlier, I'm also a runner. I really enjoy that a lot, and I've been taking a lot more walks in Seattle. The writing routine and the rigor helps, too. But yeah,
do you know what it is? Like, I mean, I know it's always like a hodgepodge. Mm-hmm. I wonder about this. Like, is it neurochemical predisposition or is it like the events of life? I guess it's some combination of two.
It has to be some combination. I think I can always track it back to like, unfortunately, like childhood and like I actually had a pretty rough upbringing.
How so? Did we talk about that? I don't want to repeat.
No, it's okay. I can't remember if he did, actually. I kind of had I had an abusive mother. We had, like, a divorce when I was 14. My parents separated, which wasn't that dramatic, but I think it's really the relationship I had with my mother and her relationship with my other siblings that kind of affected everything here on out. But I also find that experience to be incredibly valuable. I actually really like being a sad person. I actually talked about this a little bit last night. I think it gives you like some kind of heightened sense of, well, hopefully empathy if you're like in the mood for it. I also mentioned this last night during the reading that some weird little thing I kind of do with strangers is I like to pretend people might be having like the worst day of their life just in case, just to give them that extra TLC. Because I have been in situations like that where grief has been some kind of secret, which does sometimes mean that I might be overly polite, but I like, it's kind of something like I do on a day-to-day basis.
There's worse things you can do.
I hope so, yeah.
And by the way, this is the worst day of my life.
I kind of thought so.
But no, you know, you bring up a good point, and I think it's like, it's not a bad approach to life because people bury stuff and you can be moving through your day, whether it's somebody you know or it's just somebody you deal with at the drugstore or pass on the street.
Right.
You never know what people are carrying around.
Right.
And you talk about being a sad person and sort of liking it. The thought that popped into my head, we're all sad people.
Exactly.
Everybody's sad.
Yeah.
I think I think there are different approaches to it. Like some people wallow, which I have been guilty of.
Me too.
You know, some people, I think, respond with this like manic happiness and like kind of like repression and denial of their sadness or something.
Yeah.
Some people get angry. You know, people process things differently, I think.
And manifest in different ways.
Yeah. I also think there are people who just are blessed with really good neurochemistry.
I think you're right.
And are just like well adjusted and like just dispositionally happy. Those people fascinate me.
Yeah, me too. Know? They're often my friends. But yeah.
Really? And they have you around to be like, oh, this is my sad friend.
Yeah. I'm happy to supply that role. Yeah.
Well, but do you ever worry about being a toxic presence in people's life because of the sadness?
Definitely. I think that's one of the reasons why it's hard for me to like ask for help often. But because I worry about that, I think I often think about my actions a lot and making sure I'm not a burden, but you're right. It is like a conscious kind of thing. It's in the front of my mind a lot.
Yeah. It's like to be in a position where you need any kind of emotional support or other kind of support. People are always saying like, hey, you know, just like, especially in suicidal cases, it's always like, I wish they would have just said something.
Right.
I wish they would have just reached out.
But that's very hard.
It's very hard. And a lot of times, like this is the dirty truth. A lot of times they did.
Right.
And people were like, you're too much work, or I'll call you later, or, you know.
Yeah.
They kind of half helped.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, it's a lot for people to take on. And I think it gets to this issue of everybody being sad, everybody struggling. And so in a culture that I think is as stressed out as ours is, or a world that is as stressed as ours is, and a species that is as ill, I think, as ours mostly is.
Yeah.
People don't have capacity.
Right.
I think people are taxed. And so it's not that they don't have the good intentions or like a kind heart. It's just that they can't cope.
Yeah. They have a limited supply of energy, too.
That's right. And so I guess the roundabout point that I'm making is that to be somebody who has made efforts to really address their own suffering, whether it's in art or therapy or both or something, or something else, you know, spiritual pursuits, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I think those avenues are probably one's best bet if one hopes to have a higher capacity for empathy and compassion.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You know, like that's the best outcome of human suffering.
Right.
Compassion is the best outcome. Like that's...
That has to be the best outcome, yeah.
You know, otherwise what?
Nothing. It has to be that.
Otherwise darkness.
Otherwise it's not worth it.
Yeah.
That's in my experience. Like when you get the empathy back or you see the compassion, it does fill you up in like a non-cliche way. It just simply does that.
Well, and if you want to feel better, be kind to other people.
That's also very simple, right? Simple, not easy.
Yeah. And like, I always think like, I got to start volunteering. I got to like...
But you have a lot going on. Like
I do. Yeah. I mean, you know, everybody does.
Right.
Well, and this is the thing too, is that like, did you ever feel when you were writing this grief novel...
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever struggle with feelings of unworthiness where it's like, Jesus Christ, do we need another victim in the world? or this has all been said, or like I'm obviously projecting, but like, do you,
that's amazing.
Yeah. But you had that?
Yeah. I always worry. I think every narrative I try to put on there, you kind of worry about if it belongs, but I think I felt a groove with this one. I don't think I worried the fact that it was like a grief novel. I think my main concern was like how to make the character get through this. And that was like a really quote unquote fun thing to do. But no, I actually didn't worry too much about if it was going to like mess up the reader or anything. That was actually one of my main concerns, to make sure it was very engaging for the reader. I think that's why some of the best pop songs we like are also really, really sad pop songs, but they're just so good.
No, it's so weird. I just tweeted last night because I've been in this mode. I mean, it's not for that long, but I've just noticed like this pattern. Like at night I'll walk the dog and I'll listen to music and I'll be like tweeting about whatever song, like random song I happen to be listening to.
What did you tweet?
I was tweeting about this Robin song.
I love Robin.
I know.
That's amazing.
And I just put it all together. I was like, well, that's a weird synergy. But I was listening to that song Dancing on My Own.
It's such a beautiful song.
And it's like, it's got this great dual effect where it's like, wow, this is a really sad person.
Right.
And yet this is like the best dance song. Like
that song is a banger. You put that song on any wedding, everyone's out in the middle of the dance floor.
It's about this person. And like, not only is it like a sad person, but it's like a person who's kind of like petty and like stalking. It's just beautiful. Like I love
it. But it's
this.
Like the most beautiful kind of petty, right?
Yeah.
Because in the song, she's like, I don't know. I love that song because it's because she's a little weird and stalker-esque, but it's that yearning or that desire. It's all about desire. But yeah, a banger of a song. I love that song.
Yeah. So, I guess like maybe it's that kind of combination when you're and like, it's a grief song.
Right. Totally.
She's grieving the loss of a relationship, right? And like feeling jilted. And so whether it's that kind of grief or it's grief that's tied to mortality, maybe one of the solutions to the artistic conundrum, if you're trying to kind of like alchemize it and make it something that's both true but also not like a complete bludgeoning,
right,
is to try to like hybridize it in that way. And like find that weirdness.
I think finding weirdness, but also keeping it simple in a way that it's understandable for everyone, right? Like because it's that's why I studied a lot of pop songs writing the book, actually, just because what are the things like we resonate with the most and like in these like great songs? And I think once you find the kind of bare bones of that, it's really helpful driving the narrative forward.
So what songs did you study?
Actually, a ton of Robin. Like a ton of Robin.
Why her? Like just because she embodies these things?
Yeah, the exact things that we talked about. It's this like kind of weird, usually narrator with like great desire, but also great strength in the rejection almost. I often think like dealing with or being okay with rejection is incredibly like sexy. And I think Robin does that really well. That's like all about, that's part of what the song is about.
Well, no, that's the truth. And like, you know, there is strength. There's like a weird strength in you get rejected and you're like, okay, I'm going to go to the fucking club and like hide out in the corner. And
but it's also not me. And she's like, but I still love you anyways. It's like, I also like that spin to it. Like there's not this anguish, but it's more like this like self-deprecating kind of, yeah, you want to dance it away.
Well, and you can't, it's like, you can't hate the song.
No.
So this is something I've been having conversations about, like not on the show necessarily, but with friends of mine, where it's like in any kind of messaging, whether it's like writing fiction, writing nonfiction, tweeting, writing a song, it's like people who are successful and who come out, you know, come across, it's like they've found a way to express themselves in such a manner that is extremely hard to hate. Mm-hmm. Nothing to hate about it.
Yeah.
Like, and it's kind of, I don't know. Like, I guess like that might be like a really simplistic way of thinking about it, but it resonated with me. Like there's nothing you can grab onto and be like, fuck you. It's like, this is, constructed in such a way that it works on you emotionally, but it doesn't offend somehow. Like, do you understand what I was getting at?
It's the sweet spot. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like some weird sweet spot. And some people I think have a better instinct for that than others.
Yeah. I think if the goal of whatever the thing is to uplift and support, I think that generally helps it too. I think a good Robin song does kind of uplift you. That's why I listen to it. Usually I'm listening to Robin because I'm feeling kind of sad.
Yeah. Like that song, the song that we're talking about, like definitely doesn't leave you feeling sad.
No. Especially while you're brushing your teeth, it's perfect.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and we love our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at IKEA-USA.com/circular. Visit IKEA-USA.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy-on, easy-off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
So do you think about that as a writer, and especially with this book, as a, you know, it's concerned with grief? Did you think like, well, how do I want to leave people? And like, what kind of art do I want to put out into the world? Like, what kind of vibe do I want to create?
Right. I really like playing with like the tension of like what the author knows versus like what the characters know versus what eventually what the reader knows. I think when you play with that tension, it could be really fun. Especially like in a grief novel, because the reader knows this is a grief novel, and but the character is kind of living it, and you yourself, hopefully as the author, knows the trajectory. And then I think revealing it and building that suspense, or sometimes the emotional suspense, could be a lot of fun. Again, I wasn't trying to make it entertaining in a way, but I was trying to make it enough where it was compelling enough for many things to be true as on top of grief. Like, it's also a novel about friendship, a novel about animals. It's really a novel about getting through it. But I also didn't know any of these things until it was all done.
What do you think about getting through grief? Is it just time? I mean, you need friends or people around you that are supporting you. And
I think friends are incredibly helpful. Definitely time. There's a character in the novel named Amber that I had no plans for her, but she became a very vital character in the book to kind of support like Corvus while she was kind of going through this really strange trip. But yeah, in moments when I've had like really weird depression, I found some of my best friends have been not really folks that I've chosen, but people that have just stuck around and took care of me.
What do you mean? Just shown up out of nowhere and...
They tend to be like work friends or people in your proximity, you know? Not like I didn't chose them like they're not good people, but I didn't like engage with them to be like, oh, I want you to be my best friend. It's usually like they see me go through some kind of weird turmoil or They see me on a day-to-day basis, and then we develop those relationships over time. And I notice they have been, I think some of my best friends are just folks that have been in proximity of me, and we've gotten to know each other, and suddenly we become very tight. And it's because they've known that I have like a weird sadness day-to-day, and they get to know the real me that way. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, do you feel like you are willing to express that sadness, or like let on, or maybe it's just something that's just there and there's no hiding it? And because of that, people who might be more inclined to like put on a happy face or something might gravitate to you because you are manifesting or expressing something about how they feel, but might not be as willing to show or something.
I think it's very interesting that a lot of introverts tend to be friends with extroverts. I think there's something to that. I know a lot of my friends tend to be like really sensitive extroverts. I like to think of myself as like an introverted person that could like party on occasion, but and I kind of like that balance. I don't know. That's a really good question. I'm not sure why the folks or the people that I call like the ride or die in my life, like why we gravitated towards each other, but I think it usually comes out from a place of like true care and sincerity. Like I want you to be okay, and I want you to be okay. And it's also about supporting each other's projects. I think it's very interesting that a lot of like people I really care about are also like writers or artists. They tend to be sad, but they also have these projects going on. And I think we're all working to get through something. Like you said, we're all pretty sad people, or everyone's sad, but it's nice to have like this little, project that we're all kind of harnessing and chiseling down. And then once we kind of figure that out, it does make things a little better, especially when we all celebrate it together.
Just, yeah, I think there's something, I mean, I don't want to oversimplify, but there is something to like saying it, finding a form and being able to articulate it, whether it's in a fiction or not, you know, nonfiction form.
Also being candid with it, I think is being helpful. Like I'm actually like not embarrassed at all to say, yeah, I'm generally a sad person, but I'm not, but that's who I am. And I like who I am.
Do you do any therapy or anything like that?
No, but I need to. I've been actually looking for one once I get back off this book tour, I think.
And then, but like, and medication or anything? You're not medicating it?
No, I mean, I do smoke weed. I wouldn't say I smoke weed for depression. I think I just kind of, I think I heard you on a recent podcast that it's like California sober or something. Like I am from
somebody said that. I don't know if I can claim that. Who said that? Maybe it's,
Brad Phillips.
Brad Phillips. Yeah,
that's right. But I kind of feel the same way that what Brad said during that podcast was I'm like really I feel like I have 10 brains at going on at the same time sometimes, and sometimes smoking a little weed helps like mellows me out, but I wouldn't say I take it for depression. I think the things I do to depression are just like self-care things, like probably similar things that you do. Like I wake up early to go on a run. I don't quite meditate, but I do.
But I just want to stop you.
Yeah.
The run really is an antidepressant.
Oh, incredibly so.
The routine of it. The routine of it, but also the neurochemical response that it generates. Like those endorphins are real.
And I love them, yeah. I definitely get the runner's high. And I like the preparation for the run. I don't even think I even enjoy running, if I like really think about it. But I love getting through one.
Just like putting on your spandex and listening to Robin and just running around Seattle.
Yeah, a good playlist. Yeah. With a certain look on my face. Yeah, that's my jam.
It's the eye of the tiger. So you get up, you run. Mm-hmm. You said you don't meditate, but you do.
Not quite meditate. I would never call it like official or formal meditation, but I do take time to kind of think about my day and also disconnect and slow down.
You drink alcohol?
You know, not really. Like I do go out with friends on occasion, but it's not something I like look forward to often, actually.
So pot's your thing?
Definitely.
See, okay. So I used to be, for a good period, I was like, you know, I was the guy who like had a couple of glasses of wine at night.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. I'd be like,
how's that going actually? Are you still?
No. Cause remember I like there was
took a break.
It was right around, I want to say I was like, I think I can remember when I talked about it in the monologue on the show. It was like a Chelsea Martin show.
Hello, like, Chelsea.
Yeah. She's a buddy of yours.
Yeah. She's a sweet friend.
Yeah. So this was like right around, and it's always around the holidays, like the new year. I'm starting to like revamp my existence yet again.
No.
But I was just, I just started to observe it. I was like, why the fuck am I doing this? Because it was never to excess.
Right.
So I don't think it was a problem in that way, but it just was like, I just questioned it. I was like, am I really getting anything out of this? And then like, why wine? And like, what is wine for, especially for people in middle age? Like, what does that symbolize? This like bougie bullshit where everyone's like, oh, you know, I love the Rhone region. Or it's like, shut up.
Wine culture is very interesting. Like,
yeah.
It's very interesting. You can see like wine o'clock on like a t-shirt and things like that.
Well, and it's also like as a parent, you go to these kid birthday parties or you go to any of these gatherings. It's always like a hybrid event of adults and children.
Right. There's a lot of drinking.
And it's always like, oh, the moms are all having white wine. And it's like, I'm just like, not just the moms, but right, like, sure. It's just like, it's a consistent element. And I wonder at it. And it's like when people, I overthink these things and I probably get too judgy. People are just having a glass of wine. They're enjoying themselves. I'm the dick who's like sitting off to the side, like running like a social critique. But I think about these things too with like cars, you know, like what are these things? People are trying to communicate something about themselves is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, somebody's driving a Tesla. It's actually great. They're lovely cars. They're way better for the environment. But I'm the dick who's like, oh, so you're rich and enlightened.
No, you know, I've never seen a Tesla I like, so I'm right there with you.
I just wonder about like why we make these consumer choices. Mm-hmm. It's not just simply like, and I say that as an outgrowth of my own years-long wine habit.
Right.
Where I was like, why did I gravitate to this? Well, I live in California, so there's proximity. It's part of the culture. I'll embrace that. I genuinely like that it pairs with food so that like it wouldn't just be like this medication thing where you're like...
Right.
Pounding whiskey, you know,
right.
You would be eating it with or drinking it with dinner. But then I just like started to think about alcohol, started to think, and I just like, well, you know, I'm not going to do this as much. I said I was going to be done. And then now it's like every once in a while I have a glass of wine, maybe like 1 or 2 days a week, I might have a glass of wine, but it's way less than it used to be.
Right.
And I think if I'm going to do anything, like substance related, I think like eating like a little weed candy or something, especially if I'm not being social.
Right. You can like dip out a little bit.
You dip out a little bit and I find it like creatively stimulating.
Right.
So like, is that how you do it? Like you smoke pot when you're like, do you do it when you're working creatively or is it something you do when you're like unwinding and you just want to like goof off a little bit internally?
You know, I would say with writing this book, yeah, I did. It was like kind of part of my routine. I don't think it was tied to the writing because I definitely had a lot of sober writing with the book too. I don't know. I embarrassing so, or maybe not embarrassing so, I have a really high tolerance with weed. So I can kind of, it has less of an effect on me. To me, it's like really of an everyday kind of mellow kind of thing.
Creative stimulant?
I think the running actually helps more creatively than the weed does. But for me, it's all about just, the sitting down aspect of writing is like the most important part about it. And like the slowing down.
So that's what it does for you. It helps you just like sit and not want to move.
Right. It does help me focus for sure. And kind of like, and you get in the mood, I think is the appropriate way to say it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get that. I mean, like, I think like I have to be basically caffeine is my,
yeah,
like caffeinated. And
is it coffee?
I'm a little bit of tea and coffee. I drink a lot of caffeine.
Me too. It's, I've been out, like someone sent me like a, I think like a Cracked podcast the other day about just how the amount of sleep we're getting, like just diminishes like per year or not per year, but we generally all as a society used to sleep a lot more and we're not really anymore.
Do you think, okay. Cause like, this is how I feel. Like I've been thinking a lot about this cause I generally go to sleep between 10 and 11.
Yeah.
I get up at about 4:30 or 5. So I'm not getting a ton of sleep.
No, you're not getting a ton of sleep.
But I feel most days, like Friday, end of the week tends to be when I feel it the most just because of the accumulation.
Yeah, the whole week, right.
And then Saturday and Sunday, it's a little looser and I kind of try to like Sunday I've tried to like do nothing.
Sure.
I like to have my day of rest.
I think that's very necessary and very, very healthy.
Yeah, you got to have at least one day. And I try to like be unscheduled. It gets a little bit hard because you have kids stuff happening.
Of course.
But
if you have that in mind, I think the having it in mind is what helps you.
I think having like a ritual where you do give yourself some time to rest, but also like if you're not, if you're taking good care of your health,
right,
and you're exercising, and you're drinking a shit ton of caffeine, I don't feel miserable.
Good.
So maybe I can like run. Like, I guess my question is like, there's all this talk of like, well, you have to get like 8 or 9 hours. That's what human beings need. And I'm like, I think honestly, like 6 is good.
I want 8 or 9. I can operate on like 4, unfortunately. And I do on occasion or quite often. But my whole thing is like, I'll take what I can get, I think.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just like, I don't want to do damage to myself. But I'm like, this is really the only, like, I'm not going to go to bed at 8 o'clock at night.
Right.
You know, I can't.
Right.
I'm doing the best I can, but I'm just like, I guess I could sleep. If I slept more, I wouldn't have time to exercise because I have to exercise. The only time I have to exercise is early.
I need the time to fitness, I think. Also, like as a creative person, I found to be really necessary. Even just like small walks, just to kind of get out of my head. And I'm glad you also do a similar routine, sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of writers who do. There are many writers who don't, many people who don't. And
sure.
I'm honestly mystified by people who can like function at a high level
right.
without it. I'm like, wow, what kind of genes do you have? Like, that's incredible to me.
Yeah, maybe they're working out at other ways. That actually reminds me, I once had a talk with like my very good friend Willie about, because I just finished this novel and it took like a lot out of me. But it also felt really good to complete it. But I was talking about if I had the choice of like writing 10 books and then maybe somehow killing myself because of the amount of work that took versus like writing 4 books and living somewhat of a happy life, I would choose the latter. And I've just been thinking about that very particular thing a lot more actually lately, is like, because I feel I echo everything you just said about productivity and the need to kind of keep on pace with that. And I'm always going to be ambitious and kind of like wanting to do more, but I also see the need now, especially this past year, of that self-care and that, like, I think I need that more heightened sense, also empathy towards yourself. And I like figuring out how that's going to play out with my life as a writer. I think finding that balance is crucial.
Yeah, I mean, and I think if you want to be compassionate and kind to other people on a consistent basis and in meaningful ways, it has to start with yourself.
Yeah, or you're lying to everyone else.
Yeah, or you're just going to run, you're going to burn out.
Totally.
You know, like, I think that's part of my routine is like, it's the old comparison where it's like, you know, on an airplane, give yourself oxygen first. Like, that's how I feel. Like, get up really early, oxygenate yourself. And you can tend to your children. But, I don't know. I don't know how else to do it. And, I think too, like from a mood perspective, I don't know if it's because of my neurochemistry or if because it's so ingrained in me that if you don't take good care of yourself, you're just going to feel crappy and you're going to expose yourself to sickness and decay.
Totally.
And so it's hard for me to like reconcile, you know, a day is always better when I start with some motion.
I feel the exact same way. Yeah. I need to kind of get going to kind of get going. But yeah, you get a lot of great sun out here.
In Southern California.
Yeah, I miss it. I'm up in Seattle, so I think having that sun is like kind of crucial.
Well, because it's like it creates a certain pressure too. It's like it's so beautiful.
Like you have to go outside.
Like, what am I doing inside? There's like mountains, and it's always sunny. It's warm out. I mean, it's true, yeah. You know. But I kind of like that because it enforces the discipline a little bit. But,
right, you're right.
So you mentioned earlier as you were talking about your book, Corvus and a Trip. And I'm blanking on the name of the character that helped her through.
Amber.
Yeah. So, psychedelics, is this something, that you have experience with?
You know, not a ton of experience. I mean, I've done like shrooms. I've shroomed before, but, it's not like one of my go-tos or anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
But did it like an experience factor into the book, or did you have any kind of like creative breakthroughs as a result of some psychedelic experience?
No, usually when I've done most of my mushrooms experience, I've just been pretty calming and just pretty mellow. Usually it's just me just like walking through the park and feeling good with the world. And I think the novel kind of works through other troubles. But yeah, no, I don't really have much of a psychedelic experience with any substances.
No hippopotami. Like,
no, I kind of wish that. That'd be great.
Chasing you through the, I don't know, where do they live? Africa, I guess.
They live in Africa, but the hippos that are in my book are from Colombia because of the whole Pablo Escobar thing.
Oh, right.
Right.
What do you, yeah, he's like, explain for people.
Well, essentially, long story short, Pablo Escobar, during the height of his empire, brought over hippos. I forget for the exact reason. I think at one point, essentially having them as like guard dogs or something. I'm not maybe that reason, but you know, then his empire fell, and now Colombia has a huge like hippo problem because they're terribly not native to that region. But yeah, I also thought that was really fascinating that there are hippos in Colombia.
I'm fascinated by people who have exotic pets.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm also like disturbed by it. Like, why do you have a tiger? What the fuck? Did you hear this story about this house in Houston?
I did. There was like a tiger in the house?
Yeah, there's just like an abandoned house essentially. And somebody for some reason went in and was like, holy shit.
There's a tiger in there.
There's a tiger in there. I remember like Mike Tyson had a tiger. And I'm just like, this poor tiger.
I know.
Like who's, you know, I guess they steal it. They somehow get a hold of a tiger cub and then sell it on the black market.
Somehow, yeah. It's frightening. Twiggy's really cute. I like Twiggy.
She's a good girl. I've been pleased. It's like, it's been a year now and, I feel like we've developed a good like rhythm to life.
Yeah.
It's taken work though.
It was really sweet to walk, up to your steps and just seeing both of y'all there. She was just super cute.
Yeah. I try to like, I've been trying to like greet my guests on the porch.
It's a kind of iconic image. I'm like, there he is.
It's extremely iconic. Twiggy is iconic. I'm just like this guy in sweatpants with too many questions. So are you where you said you're working on a novella now?
I'm kind of working on like three random projects now. Working on a novella, working on another novel called Cave Me In. That one's about, it's a revenge novel about two women, Chloe Battles and Sarah Cush. And then possibly working on another book of short stories.
Another like female protagonists.
Mm-hmm, two of them.
So that's a kind of a consistent thread. Do you have like thoughts about that choice?
You know, I think people have been, since I've been on tour, people have been asking me this a lot lately. And I think the simple answer I like to tell is I wanted to write, you know, a book I wanted to read. But I think I'm a big fan of, do you know Hayao Miyazaki's work?
No.
He did like Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke. It's a bunch of really dope anime films. His films tend to also have like a bunch of really tight, dope female protagonists, usually younger ones, going through like a strange, surreal journey. And I think those narratives offer like a very, they're often, like I said, very surreal, but they offer a particular kind of comfort and intimacy because of everything they're going through. But yeah, it's just what I've done male characters before and same with non-binary folks. But I think so far with my novels, I've had, usually for me, it starts to figure out what's most important is like figuring out who the characters of the novel are and just kind of going from there. And in these particular two forms, they've both been female protagonists.
And it seems like you're drawing inspiration from like music and cinema.
Most definitely, yeah.
And like using those in like an explicit way. It's not like, I mean, I guess you sort of stumble into it. Like you start watching Spring Breakers and, you know, the light goes on. But you're right. Actively, when you're looking for material or trying to come up with ideas for books, you're actively turning to what, music and movies mostly?
Well, that's a really good question. Thanks, Brad. I think it's more like I like translating things I do like to see in film in prose. I think there's a lot that the image offers that I like to kind of break down and see how it might be like affecting the reader. But yeah, for me, it's a great jumping off point is figuring out how to like translate the image into something effective in prose.
Well, and I think it's interesting too, that a movie like Spring Breakers, which, you know, is very stylized and,
but that's exactly why it works like a music video, right? Like, and I'm very much like a sentence by sentence writer. Like I wasn't good at plot. And once I saw this film, to me, it almost seemed like style transcending form into content in a way. And it just needed, I just needed to see that movie to see like it could do that. Because to me, it didn't make much logical sense, but it made a lot of emotional sense. And once I had that going, it gave me kind of like license to do King of Joy.
Well, and it's also like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not a movie that like one watches and is immediately like, well, this is literary. And I think there are elements of cinema. Cinema and literature are obviously different in ways that I don't need to point out.
Sure.
But I feel like maybe if you're dealing with a really, trying to think of it, like a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, like you're watching like There Will Be Blood.
Right.
That to me feels more like a cul-de-sac.
Right.
Than a movie like Spring Breakers where there's room to move.
Sure.
You know, on the page and like ways to react to it and sure. to address the things that it's evoking in you in literature. I guess what I'm saying is that makes more sense.
Yeah, and it's also asking how you evoke those things. You had Chelsea Hodson on this podcast, and she like emphasized like atmosphere and tone. I think that's also what I'm like trying to look for when I'm watching those kind of movies. It's like, how do they accomplish that very particular kind of atmosphere and tone, and how I would be able to translate that on the page in essence?
Yeah, well, Spring Breakers is a weird movie.
Totally, yeah.
Made me like it worked on me in a strange way.
Yeah.
Like it's sort of a headache, but you can't turn away from it.
I know, it's like neon in that way.
And also like Florida. Have you ever
I've never been.
But I spent some like high school spring breaks in like Florida, and it's just like that whole state, that whole world, you know, it's just like, oh. But they get it. And like the college, like MTV spring breaks of yore.
Yeah.
That whole like beach culture and filthy.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it now.
So what movies have you seen anything lately that you, like, you really enjoyed or like have really reacted to strongly?
You know, I've been really out of it recently. I need to start rewatching a bunch of stuff. I actually rewatched this movie. I brought in a shirt, Akira. It's like an old anime film, just for some research. I like David Cronenberg's work. I've been like kind of rewatching some of his movies recently.
What was the one he did? Did he do History of Violence?
He did do a History of Violence.
That was one of my. It's one of my favorite movies.
Really, it's one of my favorite movies.
Okay, good.
I really love that film.
Yeah, I haven't seen nearly as many movies as I used to.
It's only like 100 minutes long. It's like really. I don't know. I love that. And William Hurt's in it for just 9 minutes or something, but it's like perfect.
Yeah, it's a. I don't know. I mean, like, here's like a weird confession: is that like I would have to rewatch it to like reorganize in my head sure. exactly what happens in it, but I just. There have been a small handful of films that I've seen in the 21st century that stand out. And There Will Be Blood is one of them. A History of Violence is one of them. You know, I'd have to like, you know, search my brain for the others, but that one jumps out.
I think maybe one of the reasons it might jump out, because I thought about that too with that particular movie, is like Cronenberg is like, he's known to be like this horror director. And then that's like a film where it's not quite horror. It's doing way more. It's like based on a graphic novel, but because there's like these horror elements there, it just works in like these, we talked about hybrids earlier, right? Like what makes a good pop song. And I think there's something going on in his films that he, especially that film and like Eastern Promises.
Yeah. I like that one too.
Yeah. It's like, they're not horror movies, but he's like kind of putting horror themes in like a Russian mob film. Naked knife fight scene.
Right.
Yeah.
And what's the movie? Get Out.
Right.
It's like social horror.
Exactly.
That's another film that I think would be on my list where right. it's like, wow, that was just something different. And it's, maybe this is the solution. Maybe we've cracked the code. It's like, you got to find a way to like layer your art and hybridize it to make it new and interesting.
Well, you got to make it yours, right? Because it's like, well, how would David Cronenberg do a mob film? Or like, you know, how would you do, you know, I think it's about taking, because I want to try on more genres. And I think there is, if you take on those genres, there will be something that is inexplicably your imprint on those things that I think welcomes experimentation and hopefully like figuring out what that might look like.
Yeah. Well, and I think that like, you know, sometimes people can feel constricted by genre,
sure.
Or, you know, formula and feeling like they have to hit certain marks. But I think that can actually yield interesting work sometimes, depending on how you, like, limitations can sometimes be freeing in a way.
Yeah.
Or they can force you to, have to make interesting choices.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. I concur with that.
So what genre, I mean, is there a specific genre that's on your mind or that you're working on?
I'm trying to work on a revenge novel now.
Oh, right.
So it's like just trying to figure out, like, I'm watching a bunch of really, like, really cool, like, revenge films, just trying to see what, how they accomplish what they do. And, yeah, but I think I mentioned it before, but it's also about making it fun for me and figuring out the narrative that way. Yeah.
So what are some revenge movies? I'm thinking like Kill Bill is like popping into my head.
Kill Bill. What's that? Old Boy. Have you ever seen Old Boy?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The movie's fucked up, but
they, that was remade too, wasn't it?
It was I didn't watch the remake. I think Spike Lee remade it.
Right.
Which it's whatever, but I like the original I've rewatched recently. I don't know. I actually need more recommendations for some. I've been just kind of on the scope lookout.
It's the thing I like about revenge plots is that they're simple.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like the vessel is there. You know the basic architecture.
Right. But then you can complicate it.
And then you can complicate it.
Right. Which I like. Once you figure out the core, yeah, once you know what the simplicity is, you can kind of complicate it. I love that.
What about the end, though? Like, it seems like, I mean, it's sort of brutal. It's like, I guess if the...
But you have to make a decision, right? Does it actually work or doesn't?
Yeah. I feel like my revenge novel might be, like, kind of a pussy revenge novel. At the end, the guy's like, what am I doing?
Yeah, it's going to be that moment where... am I going to kill him or not?
I just need to forgive. Just got to liberate myself.
But that'd be it. That sounds like a great book.
Maybe. Yeah. Everyone would be throwing it across the room. Just murder this person. And so what about death? I mean, since we started with grief and your book deals with grief, like, do you have a sense of, like, any kind of notion of how things go in the afterlife, or if there is one? Like, do you have feelings about that?
You know, I don't believe in God or anything. I do have a lot of respect for those folks that have relationships with God. I personally don't.
How were you raised? Did you have any of it as a kid?
I was raised kind of strange. It was like a mix of like Christianity, but also it was also kind of a Buddhist upbringing. But again, you know, my mom was it was very complicated growing up. So no, I think I do believe in reincarnation. I think there is something after, it's more like a belief in good. It's more like I try to put my more belief on people as much as I can. But as far as like life after death, I guess I haven't thought about it too much, or not enough for it to worry me.
I mean, like, right, it's going to happen.
Just yeah.
Once it does, it's out of your hands anyway.
Yeah. I think I'm more affected about like things I do in the present tense. I think I am scared of death, and like I have to be, but...
I think anybody who says they have no fear of death is full of shit.
Yeah. I mean, because I think, and it's also kind of disrespectful to the people that love you, right? If you're not scared of fear of death in any kind of way.
Yeah, you're like, yeah. Right, bring it on.
I'm like, I love you, man. What are you talking about?
We're at a child's birthday party. You tone it down, please. Yeah. You know, it's like, I think like where I'm at with it is I'm not necessarily afraid of being dead. But the dying process, it seems natural to be a bit concerned.
Yeah, the dying sounds like it sucks, but...
It can. I mean, or there's people who have, like, you know, relatively peaceful exits.
Sure.
And...
have you ever had a near-death experience?
You know, I asked myself this in the writing of my book, and there was one time I was on an airplane flying from Florida after a spring break, and we were connecting in Charlotte.
Uh-huh.
On our way home to the Midwest.
Uh-huh.
And the plane went, like, it was kind of windy, so it was, like, wobbly on the way down.
Yeah.
And, like, it was one of those things where, like, we touched down on the runway.
Uh-huh.
And we're, like, coming to a halt, and then all of a sudden, like, powered back up and took off again.
Oh, my God.
Because there was another plane on the runway.
Oh, my God.
So I guess that would count.
I think that totally counts, yeah.
But at the time, I was just like, okay. I mean, it was definitely, like, alarming.
Was everyone else alarmed? I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, everyone's always, I think there's always a weird tension on airplanes, period. That goes unspoken.
Do you remember feeling any way afterwards? Like, did you do anything special?
I mean, I was like 16.
Okay.
You know, and I think, oh my God, now I'm remembering that I brought, like, this was old school. This was like, you know, pre-cell phone, but I had like a dictaphone.
Yeah.
This is like so telling. This is something I haven't thought about in years and years and years, but
yeah,
for some reason on that spring break, I brought a dictaphone and was like walking around like,
and you
sort nice. Of like, it was like early iterations of the podcast.
That's amazing, man.
Yeah. I don't know. It's kind of weird, but
but that's why I asked it. Usually like when something like that happens, it's like, what do you do after the fact? Right.
Well, the reason that it sparked this memory is that I remember walking up the little jetway, like, you know, have a little tunnel that connects to the airplane.
Most definitely. Yeah.
I was with a buddy. We were on the same flight. And he and I were walking up the jetway afterwards. And the reason I remember the dictaphone is that I interviewed him basically as we walked up the jetway about his feelings about that takeoff. And he said to me, like, as a joke, he's like, I'm just happy to be alive.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Do you still have that somewhere?
I don't think so.
Oh, my God. That's perfect.
Yeah. So that would be mine. I mean, do you have one?
I survived like a really pretty major car accident like almost 10 years ago. I was in the passenger seat. My friend Jen was driving. My buddy Jesus was in the back. We were going from San Diego to LA on the 5. Somewhere around Orange County, there was a car that like swerved into our lane, bumped us on the right. That basically causes a swerve out of control. And we were, I think we hit a 16 wheeler on our right hand side and then got caught underneath. And was dragged underneath while the 16-wheeler was braking. I was the only one injured, but it was like the side of the car was like collapsed on my side. Ended up having like 9 staples on my head. But yeah,
were you unconscious?
No, we got to the hospital right away. The ambulance came real quick. I remember thinking I was going to die. Like my buddy Jesus was holding me, and I was actually pretty at peace. But probably because I was in shock. Most definitely because I was in shock. But yeah, I actually wrote about it.
I want to say we might have talked about this.
I think we might have, but it was an incredibly valuable experience only because in some weird... I kind of think of myself like as an absurd person in a weird way too. Just like... I kind of think like I get a, like every day I have now is some kind of bonus. So I do think of it as special. Which I think you kind of have to just kind of get through the mundane, weird things of the day. But
well, and every day, I mean, you know, like this is the thing about life. You never know when it's going to end. You don't know when there's going to be an accident or some weird illness or, you know.
Right.
So every day is kind of a bonus. And
right. But I actually started writing much seriously after that car accident because I didn't want to like waffle anymore. And it felt like it was time. It was cool, though. But yeah, I think it helps kind of recalibrate you and kind of like get you in line.
And the feeling lasts? Because like what I think I hear sometimes, or I guess maybe what I'm concerned about, is that you have one of these threshold experiences and you come out of it on a kind of high where
sure.
your priorities are suddenly clear to you.
Yeah, and you're going up in like 100 miles an hour, yeah.
You have energy. Mm. You're like, okay, like I have a sense of purpose. I've like maybe a certain fearlessness.
Sure.
Or a diminishment of fear.
Sure.
Appreciation for life and everything. But
yeah, all those things.
But then it's like, do you then, like, you know, a year later, 6 months later, find yourself like reverting back to old form where you've lost that shine?
Of course you do. But I actually celebrate the anniversary every year. So it's kind of like you always kind of revert back. There's always a return back to something. But it's also kind of up to me to kind of figure out how to get lifted again.
How do you celebrate?
Usually I have certain friends that just kind of know that the date's coming up.
What's the date?
It's the week before Halloween. So usually I don't even like pinpoint. Usually around, yeah, the date before Halloween. I actually celebrate the party I went to, like when I got home. Anyways, that's a longer story. But usually like, I just go out with friends and just have drinks. And I'm not much of a drinker, but that day I do drink.
You don't drive, though.
No, I don't drive. Definitely don't drive. I'm not a driver at all.
It's a great way to mark the moment. You're not a driver?
No.
How do you get around?
I mean, I got here in a Lyft. I live in Seattle, and it's pretty public transport friendly.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, I just sold my car.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Well, it was like an older car, and I was like, it needed some repairs, and I was like, this is like worth more than what the car's worth. So I just got rid of it.
That sounds great.
We're going to go with one car. I ride my bike a lot.
This is a great biking city.
It should be better if there
the
were
voice
like
is cracking. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
It's like I'm going through puberty again.
But no, I guess like I've been thinking a lot lately. I've been reading too much about climate change, and it's fucking terrifying.
Yeah, it's very scary.
And I'm like, you know what? I have kids who are going to one day be bearing the brunt of this.
Yeah.
And if they look back and they're like, wow, my parents didn't do shit to like try to like, you know, stop this or like change their behaviors and acknowledge at least the reality of this, that's not going to age well.
Right.
So I think part of me is like, I want to see how long I can go. You know, it might be the case that work stuff and life circumstances dictate that I have to have my own vehicle. But like, if I think about, for example, like leasing or buying a car and making a monthly payment, like at the point that I'm at now, I think I could just take a Lyft if I really need to get somewhere.
If you really need to get somewhere. Right?
And at my current, jump on a bus or take the train or something, or ride my bike.
Right.
I think between those options, I would probably have to go quite a ways, or circumstances would have to change quite a lot for those costs to exceed what I would be paying for a car.
Right. The car fascinates me. It's like, it's always kind of fascinated me, because like we're driving around these crazy, they're not crazy because they're not sentient, but
not yet.
Yeah, right.
Wait till the 2020 Tesla comes out. That's going to be the next like status symbol. Like, is your car sentient?
Yeah, who do we? But yeah, it's funny flying over here from New York to Los Angeles, seeing all those highways that, because I'm from California, just seeing them all again, it's like, wow, yeah, I forgot about those highways. It's just amazing that we spend so much time in our cars. I think it does evoke a lot of thinking time in cars. I think thinking in traffic is actually valuable thinking time. But yeah.
I don't like it.
It gets wild.
I mean, I like some of it. I like some listening to a podcast or some music in a car.
Yeah.
But driving in this town is a fucking nightmare.
Yeah. Especially if you're a scheduled person. It's kind of like an anomaly sometimes, right?
Especially if you're a sane person. Like, who really? I mean, you know, the situation that we're in, like, there's got to be a better way. And I think it comes down to public transportation.
Yeah.
And, like, people figuring out, like, build a monorail. Build some system.
Well, a car takes up so much space for just, like, one person.
Yeah. It's very inefficient, and it's bad for the planet.
Yeah.
And, like, the thing, too, though, is that, like, flying, you know, like, that's another thing I've been thinking about. Like, if we're gonna mitigate this even a little bit, and there's some pretty grave news just coming out from the UN, like, this past week, where it's like,
yeah,
the ship has sailed. The Arctic's going to raise 5 to 9 degrees in the next, like, 100 years.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to be a catastrophe no matter what we do at this point, because we have fucking failed to act, you know?
Yes.
And future generations are going to look back on, I think, the baby boomers in particular, just because they were driving the economy for the longest period of when we kind of knew that this shit was happening.
Yeah.
And could have acted.
Right.
Didn't.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a little simplistic, but I'm just thinking, like, there's going to be in the future some pretty significant rage, you know, when people are living in.
I think there's already rage. It's already building, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was just the school walkout and the protests, right. You know, and good. Yeah. The young people are like, hey, we're the ones that are going to have to deal with this stuff, you
assholes. I think the kids are going to be all right. Yeah, like, when I, like, feel all the same way you do, and when the little bit of hope I do get out of it is, like, if you do spend some, like, I know you're a wonderful father, but if you spend time with, like, I spend time with some activist youths, and they're so much smarter than I've ever will be. Like, they're so much in tuned with both their emotions and, like, what they want out of the world, and they have a lot, I wouldn't say a lot of fight in them, they do, but they also have, like, something extra that, maybe because I'm getting older now and I think kids are just fucking dope anyways, but you're totally right. I think it is going to be totally rougher, and I worry about those times, but I do like what the kids are doing.
Well, I think, like, that's the thing, is that circumstances, especially as they mount and the catastrophe mounts,
yeah,
it's going to, one way or another, it's either going to be annihilation mm-hmm. or there's going to be a shift in consciousness. And like, hopefully we're seeing a shift in consciousness where people are reevaluating how we relate to one another and how we relate to our natural environment and to animals and to all of it, you know, plants, animals, oceans, all of it. And to understand the responsibility that we have and the interconnectedness that there very much is.
Right.
And that we don't have dominion over it, that we're not separate from it, that we're not better than it, you know?
Yeah.
We're just another animal on this planet, and we happen to be responsible for completely fucking it up.
Right.
You know, and like to accept that responsibility and to make necessary changes would seem like the saner way to go. And what's so insane about the present moment is that we have like a president and a power structure on the right that is really among Western democracies, or like any, pretty much any country.
Yeah.
Like, it's like the only major political body in the world, you know, with, I don't, you know, maybe there's some like in the Middle East or something that is like denying the reality of this science. Like, it's bananas batshit crazy.
Yeah. Causing more and more damage in that denial.
Yeah. And, but also on top of it, like sort of getting to the point where you're like, oh my God, like they kind of want this to happen. And they're already scheming for like how to make money off of it.
Yep.
And what was, I was just thinking about this morning during my sunrise joy walk, where I was like, I think I'm thinking about my kids' futures and like maybe my grandchildren.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
you have to though.
Yeah. But it's, what I was thinking about is that like you have these rich people. Like, it's already a world of haves and have-nots, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you layer on top of that, like, the disasters associated with climate change. And those are going to affect rich people, too.
Yes.
Like, Manhattan could be underwater.
Yeah.
You know, Miami, gone. You know, like, people are going to get displaced. Like, these things are going to inconvenience everybody.
Right.
But to different degrees, because people with resources can relocate.
Exactly right.
So then I start thinking about the planet heating up. It's already unbearable in the summer in most places.
Yeah.
But you know, even in places that are more or less temperate, or more temperate, it can get, you know, you can have your 105 to 110 degree day. So I'm starting to think like, oh my God, you're going to wind up having like a class system that is rooted in people who spend winters in the opposite, or winters wherever they are, the colder months wherever they are, and then they change poles.
Yeah.
So you'll have people with two homes. It's like, oh, in the hot months, I'm going to leave the northern hemisphere and go to the southern hemisphere. And then in the southern months, you know, when it starts to get to be summer, I'll just go back up to the north.
That sounds like a nice budget.
Yeah. It sounds like a sci-fi movie, some sort of like future novel. You're welcome to whoever is listening. But it's like, if you don't have that option, then you're just stuck in the summer. But right. I think like one of the future status symbols is like, oh, I can buy real estate in the mountains in two different poles. And just like, you know, because we're all going to be like microchipped by that point and like what, you know, internet and everything else,
yeah.
That you're just going to be able to live a bipolar existence. Am I crazy? Does that sound, it sounds like that, because people don't want to be inconvenienced, right? They're rich. They want things how they want things. They're not going to want to be in 120 degree heat.
Yeah.
You know, I guess some people do out in Palm Springs or whatever, but fuck that. Like most people, it's like, I'm not going to broil. I'm going to go to where it's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. We're all fucked, man. And like, I think about the disenfranchised folks of, the folks that get left behind when everyone else moves. Yeah. It's just going to get hotter, like you said. Sorry, I spaced out over there.
That's all right. I mean, it's like, it's a lot to process. And, you know, I don't have all the answers, but it's just like, it's been in the news lately, so I think it's on my mind.
Yeah.
So you're off to San Francisco next.
Yes.
And then it's back to Seattle, and it's back to your routine.
Yeah.
And you have, like, three books going.
Yeah, I think just... three projects, maybe two, maybe one. I think I'm just going to focus on the new novel now, but it's like, I like having a balance of things.
And what is your, do you have like a strict regimen? Like, do you write every day?
You know, I used to be a big proponent of the writing every day thing. I still try to aim for it, but I also try to forgive myself if I can't do it. I've learned that that's also really valuable as well. But yeah, I try to put in a little half hour each day. It's very similar to my running. Like, if I can do that, it's usually one or the other.
Like a half hour, you said?
Half hour to an hour. If I'm having a really good day, 2 hours.
And then you can get books done that way.
Eventually, yeah, little by little each day.
Why? But why? Is it because that's as much attention? Like, that's the limits of your attention span and your energies? Or is it because of just work stuff? And
I usually work like, I also work a full-time job. So it's usually just because that's usually how much time I can cram into my day.
So you're teaching? Is that what it is? Or
I'm teaching. I'm also, I teach for Hugo House and Catapult online. And I also, I work a accounts receivable at a bookstore.
Which bookstore?
The University Bookstore in Seattle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're wonderful folks.
That's good.
Yeah.
I mean, you're kind of around it.
Yeah. Yeah, but I like doing the numbers side of it. Kind of balance things out. I don't like taking anything home, which is really nice.
And what about reading? Like, do you have like a heavy reading diet? Do you make like actual time for that?
You know, my last year is probably my worst reading year. But I've been trying to bring the count back up. I try to average like, I think Mary Ruffel once said she reads about a book a week. I try to do that, like a book a week, but sometimes that can be hard. I try to average about a book a week.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's healthy.
I try for it. It doesn't always happen, but yeah. I always try to have a new book in the bag.
And what about movie? I mean, like if you draw so much inspiration from like music and movies, like do you ever dabble in screenwriting? Are you going to drop an album anytime soon? Richard's dance album is coming out.
I do love dancing.
Wait, you do?
Yeah, I love dancing.
Like, will you go out dancing?
I don't actively do. I think more if someone invites me, I take up the opportunity. But
are you good?
I could cut a rug.
Okay,
yeah,
I don't know.
A little rug.
But like, do you have the abandon? Because I like
that's
one,
a great question. Yes.
Yeah, because it's like it's not about necessarily like are your moves like textbook and like do you look like somebody in a music video? It's like, do you have the ability to?
I feel the beat. Yeah, you have to feel the beat.
Oh man,
you gotta let loose, man.
I don't feel the beat.
Let loose. You're thinking too much.
I know.
Don't think. Just feel the beat.
Fuck.
But yeah, that's why I love dancing. It's one of the moments where I just don't care.
How often are you doing this?
You know, like in my bedroom, but then on occasion I do go out with friends. There's not a lot of spots in Seattle for that, but maybe I'll go out once I'm here in LA.
There's places to dance.
There's some clubs here. Yeah.
I wouldn't be able to tell you where they are, but I know they exist. Well, it's good to see you.
Thank you, Brad.
I mean, this is the first time we met in person, right?
First time we met in person, yeah.
But the second time we've talked on this show, congratulations on the book.
Thank you, sir.
Best of luck on the other myriad projects you have going.
Thank you so much for having me on here. It's a big honor.
All right, everybody. That's Richard Chim. His new novel is called King of Joy. It's available from Soft Skull Press. You can find him online at richardchim.com. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle over there is @giganticanovel. Richard Chim, the novel again is King of Joy. Go get your copy right now. It's available from Soft Skull. Go get it. Thanks to Kill Rockstars and the band Stereo Total for the theme song music, as always. Thank you to Tiger in My Tank for the interstitial music. If you would like to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com. That's letters@otherppl.com. Let me know what you think. Tell me a story. If you would like to support this program, patreon.com/otherpplpod. You can tip your server if you are moved to do so. Don't forget about the Other People app. This podcast has its own official app, the Other People with Brad Listy app. Go check it out. It's free. It's a free app. It's a great way to listen. So, my kids are on spring break. That's always fun. It's like a preview of summer. I feel like the chaos level is higher than usual. My sisters were both in town. I was out of town for a few days. I'm catching up. But the podcast rolls on. I've got some good episodes coming up next week on the program. What do I have for you? Ooh, this is interesting. I have Lori Gottlieb. And she's got a book called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. She's a therapist who has written a book about being a therapist and also being in therapy. So we had a good talk. Very interesting. And stay tuned for that. Otherwise, I think that's it.